Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to read an article I didn't get to last week. June 1963, Girl Groups Take Over. And then the Mojo interview with the Stranglers, Jean-Jacques Burnel. And a classic album review of Blue Album by Weezer. Okay, we start off with the Time Machine article, June 1963, Girl Groups Take Over. June 8th, it's My Party by Leslie Gore was at U.S. number one on the Hot 100. Produced by Quincy Jones and sung by a 17-year-old scion of comfortable Brooklyn family, the song was a spry, Latin-tinged rush of teenage heartbreak at a birthday soiree, wherein dastardly love interest, Johnny, transfers his affection to the treacherous Judy. Listeners went ape. And here's a little bit of that song, It's My Party by Leslie Gore. When I sing, I really like to rip it up. The wilder the better, Gore told the NME on June 28th, adding that she always traveled with a family member or a chaperone. Almost since I can remember, I've wanted to make records. I've sung my head off in front of people whenever I've had the chance. Elsewhere in the charts, there were other surges of female sung emotion by artists who would later be included in the pantheon of girl groups. The Chiffons, One Fine Day, the Shirelles, Foolish Little Girl, and, despite the presence of male singer Bobby Sheen, Not Too Young to Get Married by Bob B. Sox and the Blue Jeans. The later was produced by Phil Spector, who had heard It's My Party demo disc, which was sung by Cliquettes singer Barbara Jean English. He resolved to cut the song with Brooklyn vocal group The Crystals. In the event Gore, Gazumped, The Crystals, and Helen Shapiro, who had recorded the song before anyone, into the charts. Even so, Spector had reason to be cheerful. The Crystals' soaring song of eternal love, Do Da Do Run Run, When He Walked Me Home, was at its peak position of U.S. number three this week. Spector's first songwriting collaboration with Jeff Berry and Ellie Greenwich. The gibberish title was intended to be replaced by a more comprehensible lyric until the producer decided to make a virtue of it. Given manic intensity by Spector's wall of sound, maximalism, it struck a chord with British listeners too, entering the UK top 40 on June 20th and peaking at 5 in July. And here's a little bit of that song from The Crystals, Da Do Run Run.
I met him on a Monday and my heart was filled. Da Do
Along the way, however, a mystery arose which involved the voice of the Crystals and Bob B. Sox and the Blue Jeans. The June 29th edition of Record Mirror reported, the rumor got around that the two groups were one and the same. Los Angeles girl group The Blossoms were also implicated. The complex mind of Spector is the key to the puzzle. The Crystals had U.S. hits with him in 61 and 62, until that year's warped He Hit Me, and It Felt Like a Kiss turned off radio programmers and bombed. They were back at the top in November with the Gene Pitney-penned Rev Up, He's a Rebel, though the song had actually been recorded by The Blossoms, with lead vocals by Darlene Love. Phil and the Crystals weren't on speaking terms at the time anyway, Love told the San Francisco Chronicle in 1982. But he owned the name so he could use it. Our recording sessions are more like parties, Spector told Record Mirror in early 64. We have sandwiches, drinks, and we sit around laughing and chatting. But we work. Just to clear up a few details, Darlene used to be with Bob B. Sox. That's how I found them, because of Darlene. She works on many other discs for other labels. Although she isn't billed, she is a great talent. Love and the Blossoms also sang on the Crystals' February 63 U.S. number 11, He's Sure, The Boy I Love. But on Dadu Ron Ron, cut at Gold Star in Hollywood in March. The Crystals, Dolores Lala Brooks, who was a mere 16, sang lead. She told the NJ News site in 2012 that, I was afraid to disturb Spector going over Dadu Ron Ron. 30 takes, 40 takes, 45. That's a lot of takes to keep going over and over to get exactly what he wanted. He did, and for a time, it seemed, the pop landscape was ruled by girl groups. Hits including the Janettes, Sally, Go Round, The Roses, the Angels, My Boyfriend's Back, and the Cookies, Girls Grow Up Faster Than Boys, followed in the next 6 months. And in October, the Ronettes Spector-produced epic Be My Baby was a transatlantic smash. And here's a little bit of that song, Be My Baby, from the Ronettes.
Place.
In December, the Spector Stable came together on the classic Yule LP, A Christmas Gift for You from Phillies Records. Yet, the Crystals and the Ronettes' hit-making days were done by 1964. The madness of Spector is well documented. Ronettes singer Ronnie Spector, who was married to the producer from 1968 to 1974, detailed his abusive behavior in her 1990 memoir, Be My Baby. Serving a prison sentence for murder, Spector died in 2021. Speaking in 2006 to The Observer, Ronnie reflected on her complicated life and music with defiance. "I don't do regrets," she said. "I made some great pop records, songs that people hold in their hearts through their whole lives. Ain't nobody can take that away from me." Now we're moving on to the Mojo interview with Gene Jacques Burnell of The Stranglers. Keeping The Stranglers afloat, defying punks and prudes, despite losing Bitter Hugh, Genius Dave, and A Year on Heroin, has taught Gene Jacques Burnell a thing or two about rock and roll. It's not dyeing your hair with Just for Men. Chatting to Mojo over a fish restaurant lunch in the port of St. Laurent du Var, Nice, Gene Jacques Burnell is recalling a recent TV chat with the UK's Channel 5 News. "You're the only original one still in The Stranglers," noted the show's hapless anchor. "Keep in touch with the others?" Burnell's riposte sidestepped his long, ongoing estrangement from former frontman Hugh Cornell, but not late bandmates Jet Black and Dave Greenfield. "I said yes, but only through a medium." Irreverence being a keynote on his half-century with the band, such Black humor figures. In his 2023 memoir, Strangler in the Light, Burnell's co-writer Anthony Boyle characterized the Stranglers' ethos as a blend of brutality and sophistication, crudeness and intelligence. Burnell, their belligerent karate ace and co-provocateur, seemed to relish a bit of aggro with rival punk acts and journalists. And when the group was accused of misogyny or jumping on the punk bandwagon, physical altercations often ensued. Happily, today's encounter has a rather different tenor to that which, in 1978, ended with writer Philippe Monigorv gaffer-taped to the Eiffel Tower 400 feet up after bugging Burnell. Now 73, Beloskidi in check, the well-preserved bassist, "I can still kick arse, I'm not decrepit yet," chats about the Provence Alpes Côte d'Azur region's rose vineyards and enthuses about Strange Bird, the local blues covers band he moonlights in with the Yardbirds' Jim McCarthy. "It might seem like overkill, but I still love playing live," he says, sipping a vin blanc with creme de cassier. "You're imbibing it all, getting a hero's welcome." Purveyor of peaches, meaty, overdriven bass hook, and co-writer of such indelible punk classics as Something Better Change, Burnell brought Gaelic cultural kudos to the Stranglers, not just menace and good looks. Here's a little bit of the song Something Better Change by the Stranglers.
Don't you like the way I move when you see me? Don't you like
Born in Notting Hill to French restaurateur parents from Normandy, he'd study classical guitar and processed the pop noise of Yi Yi, the reach of Debussy, and the lyrical depravity of Serge Gainsborough, before hooking up with his Stranglers bandmates in Guildford, Surrey in 1974. Cross-pollinated with drummer Jet Black's jazz background, Dave Greenfield's prog rock-inspired keyboard, Arcapello's and Cornwell's love of the Velvet's Underground and The Doors, such influences primed the Stranglers, initially hard, gigging pub rockers alongside Dr. Feelgood et al. For longevity. With 1977's Raddus Norvegus, they emerged as one of punk's most potent, idiosyncratic, and commercially successful acts, Cornwell and occasional Burnell handling vocals. Today, ahead of Stranglers' dates in Australia and New Zealand and a UK tour, Burnell clearly relishes being the band's de facto custodian figurehead. Yet, he's quick to point out that current singer-guitarist Baz Warn has ably fronted the Stranglers for 18 years. "There won't be a Stranglers after I'm gone, though," he adds. "It's been discussed." You're a Shihan, or chief instructor in karate, black belt seventh dan. Does that explain your durability? I think so. Even this morning, I was doing weighted squats and kicks, but the millimeter is accumulating. When did you stop competing? I stopped tournaments at 41, but I should have stopped much earlier. My last one was here in Nice, actually. I met the French champion, who was number two in the world at the time, and he knocked me out live on Eurosport. You can look it up. Your parents moved to London from Normandy in the 1950s. What music did you hear at home? My dad was a huge fan of tango music, which he discovered in the 1930s while working as a chef on the French line between La Havre and Buenos Aires. My mom liked all kinds of stuff. She told me she saw Django Reinhardt playing with Stephanie Grappelli during the wartime curfew. That was in Cannes in Normandy, where my family is from. Unlike most punks, you studied classical guitar. Yes, with a great guy called Frank Winslade, who also taught John Renborn of Pentangle at one point. Frank taught me in a church hall opposite the offices of the Surrey Advertiser in Guildford when I was 12. He took me to see Segovia at the Royal Festival Hall. Everyone was like, "Oh, Segovia's got arthritis now," but he sounded pretty good to me. Then back at home, I was in front of the mirror impersonating Pete Townsend. I was in the throes of becoming a teenager during the British blues boom. I also loved I Get Around by the Beach Boys, which I'd heard on Radio Luxembourg one summer when I was shipped off to my grandparents. I can hear a Beach Boys sensibility in 1977 Stranglers single Go Buddy Go. Here's a little bit of that song by the Stranglers, Go Buddy Go.
Dancing around, dancing all night to the crazy sound.
I hope so, but there was so much else going on as well. The Stranglers were always open about our influences. All that stuff about punk being year zero was bullocks. So we got chastised for saying we liked the Doors. What about Serge Gainsbourg? Did his lyrical daring influence the Stranglers? Listen, anyone who talked so openly about sex had my vote. Je t'aime, mon plus. Harley Davidson, what a guy. And the way Gainsborough nicked from people like Chopin was clever too. At school in Northwood Hills, Middlesex, you got stick for being French. Was the physical bullying you experienced a factor in your becoming a bit handy? Of course. But your father, Roger, was physically violent to you, and so was your grandfather when you stayed with your maternal grandparents in Cannes. Yes, but my grandfather had survived the Battle of Verdun, where he'd been gassed. The skin on half his face was burnt off, and he had to put these powders and ointments on it. He was an alcoholic. If someone looked at him the wrong way in the street, he'd just punch them out. I remember being about 14 and having to carry him home from the bistro. I remember being in the bog and him trying to break the door down to attack me. He had this leather truncheon with lead inside it. Was he suffering from PTSD? Very likely, but I could be a bit of a wind-up too. And the same thing to provoke my dad. I was a well-educated kid who ended up going to the Royal Grammar School in Guildford, but my dad left school at 14. I had his intellectual arrogance, which incensed him. Your mother, Georgette, was embarrassed by the Stranglers' name and told friends it was a misspelling and you were actually called the Strangers. Laughs, that's right. She was fully aware of our bad reputation, but she would still defend me. When we were arrested here in 1980 for supposedly inciting a riot at one of our concerts, inspiring the Stranglers' song, Nice in Nice, my mom was waiting for me when we got out of jail. She offered to take me to a Michelin-starred restaurant, and I gladly accepted. In Guildford in 1974, when Jet and Hugh first approached you, you were about to go to Japan to get your black belt, right? Yes, I was saving up 5 pounds a week. I wanted to go there and find out how good I was. I was fascinated by Japan and Japanese culture because of karate and people like Japanese novelist and political activist Yoko Mishima. I'd read about Mishima's attempting coup d'etat and how it ended with him committing seppuku, Japanese ritual suicide, by disembowelment. It seemed notable to me, heroic. So how did Hugh and Jet convince you to join them rather than travel? Hugh knocked on my door in Guildford. We sat and chatted, and then I sang him Go Buddy Go. He said, our bass player's gone back to Sweden. Would you like to join us? First rehearsal. I'd done a karate tournament in Kingston during the day, so I turned up with my arm in a sling. But I got in, and I inherited the Swedish guy's Fender, which is now owned by Adam Clayton. How did you find Dave Greenfield? Well, through an ad in Melody Maker. He turned up with long hair and a bag over his shoulder, flares, black and white Cuban heel boots, and a lit fag in his mouth. We had this little keyboard that he played the shit out of, and we all just looked at each other. Suddenly, we had a real musician on board. What were your early impressions of your bandmates? We were such desperate people. We didn't know the rules of the game, but we were fighting our corner. Hugh was very funny, very erudite, cultured about music, and very ambitious. Jet was also very well read. A good business head on him, but violent too, especially when he was hungry, laughs. He was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in later life, but I reckon he had it all along, and that contributed to his mood swings. And Dave? Dave was just Dave, unique. Later on, when we lived next door to each other in a little village called Somersham in Cambridgeshire, our local doctor diagnosed him with Asperger's. Did that have a bearing on his musicality? Well, we didn't need a sequencer live. Let's put it like that. There's a song called Gentex on the Raven with a huge amount of sequencing on it, but Dave just learned every note. You traveled to gigs in one of Jet's old ice cream vans. Yeah, in Bedford Calmer. By that point, it had WCG on the side, which stood for Wide Wine Central, Guildford, because Jet also sold mail-order wine kits. I used to sit up front with him, and we'd listen to the Bedford's engine ticking over. I'd ask him what rhythm it corresponded to, and he'd say 6/8 or whatever. When Andrew Lauder signed you to United Artists, you'd already been rejected by 25 other companies. He was friends with our managers, Day Davies and Derek Savage. We did over 200 gigs in 1976, sometimes two a day, and Andrew kept coming to them. There was always some mass brawl at the Red Cow or the Hope and Anchor in Islington. But Andrew knew we had something. Where did that air of menace surrounding the Stranglers come from? Rejection. People didn't like us. One time we were playing at the Torrington in North Finchley in 1976, and this bunch of kids dressed like character punks tried to storm the stage. We weren't having it, and we started playing our songs, tits to them. They shut up and declared that we were their band. And here's a little bit of that song, Tits, by the Stranglers.
And you're listening to Jimmy Young on Radio 1 with his recipes. Okay, so like, first I'm going to tell you who's up here. The truth will be told for once and for all. And then we want you to tell us what to play and we'll try and play it, alright? But I'll tell you now, we don't know my old man's a dustman. So don't shout out for that.
Those kids were later known as the Finchley Boys, right? Yeah, the Finchley Boys, yes. Quite a hard lot from North London, with some black kids and some Cyprox among them. They gave us confidence, and they would have massive punch-ups with Clash and Pistols fans, glorifying in it. You seem to like a bit of aggro, too. I loved it. That would be antithema to me, sickening. Yeah, but you didn't grow up with it. It was violent all the time, and we became injured to it. We became inured to it. We developed this kind of ghetto mentality, and we felt that London was ours, that it didn't belong to all these phony, fabricated punk bands. In your book, you say the Clash and the Pistols were like the Monkees, put together and told what to say. Listen, let's not diss the Monkees, laughs. No, the bad blood was because I had a little contempt with the Clash's Paul Simeon outside Dingwalls in Camden, in full view of the NME. It polarized opinions, and we were the baddies. It was the same night, July 4th, 1976, we supported the Ramones and the Flamin' Groovies at that American Bicentennial gig at the Roundhouse. A lot of people's noses had been put out of joint. They didn't like us being chosen for that. You also had a motto, truth through provocation. Yeah, we'd wind people up during the encore. It's great being here in Edinburgh because we know that you're English, really, whereas the people of Glasgow know they're Scottish. Seats would get ripped out. Another newspaper headline. We thought it was all a game, but there were repercussions. Do you remember writing Peach's bass hook? Yeah, it was after me and Hugh had been to this sound system event in action. We'd lent out our PA, and we heard these guys toasting and rapping, all this amazing dub reggae stuff, with loads of room for bass and the odd delayed snare drum. I remember a spliff going round, but going right past us. I wrote the riff back at our squat in Chiggenfold, trying to get that sense of space. Peaches isn't proper reggae as such, but we were way ahead of the Clash, or whoever with that kind of crossover. You can hear that Hugh is kind of rapping. Was Hugh's unorthodox pronunciation of clitoris an attempt to escape the censor? Oh, he didn't care about the censor. It just worked better rhythmically than cunt. Was Peach's lyric sexist? It's certainly voyeuristic. Well, don't you ever use your eyes? Voyeur in French means someone who looks, whereas in English it has implications. You're a young man, you're walking along the beach, and you see a woman, and you see women in bikinis. Of course, you're going to look. London Lady was darker, though, wasn't it? Derogatory about the music journalist Caroline Kuhn. It brought charges of misogyny. And here's a little bit of that song, London Lady by the Stranglers.
Plastic show when you're a sick.
so pleased about. Tell me what you got to look so pleased about.
It was about a few women, not one particular woman, and wasn't Caroline Coon an aficionado of the Pistols? We decided all that lot were enemies. Also, when we started to fill out venues, there were various women who were interested in us for impure reasons. The lyric is cruel, though, isn't it? It's very cruel, yes, rotten, and I certainly wouldn't be cruel like that now. So you mellowed? Mellowed? Well, it's not a dirty word. No, it's not. It's been a process. Teaching karate, I have a responsibility to kids I'm mentoring. When you give an irresponsible twat responsibility, and all my twatnessness has been very well documented, they often mature and come up to the bar. It's a tactic people use. I've seen that with the kids I teach and also with myself. I suddenly realized I'm not immortal, that I can get hurt emotionally. So knowing that, let's find the best way to negotiate life. I also get hurt more easily physically because my students want to beat the shit out of me. You're still sparring at 73? Well, a little bit. I wouldn't want to stop sparring completely. I feel like AW was misconstrued, not least by the BNP. But there's also a story about Jet defending a member of reggae band Steel Pulse, who is dressed in Ku Klux Klan garb while performing the Steel Pulse protest song of the same name. Steel Pulse supported us on our 1978 Black and White tour. We became really friendly. But when we got to Wolverhampton, one of the guys, possibly Mikhail Riley, got booed by a portion of our crowd when he put on the KKK outfit. All four of us got on stage and Jet said, "These are our guests. If you've got a problem with that, we're here down the side waiting for you." End of. Golden Brown was a UK number two in February 1982. Was it difficult when that level of success didn't sustain? And here's a little bit of that song, Golden Brown, by the Stranglers.
Golden Brown, texture like sun, lays me down with my mind. She runs throughout the night, no need to fight, never a frown with Golden Brown. Every time, just like the last, on her ship, tied to the mast, to distant lands, takes both my hands. Never a frown with Golden Brown. Golden Brown, fine temptress, through the ages she's heading west, from far away, stays for a day, never found with Golden Brown.
No, because a worldwide hit like that is rare, and we knew we didn't want to make another Golden Brown, following a formula ad nostrum. We actually forced the label to release it. We had a clause in our contract which could invoke that demand. They put it out in January, expecting to drown in the New Year tsunami. And when it was a huge hit, they wanted more of the same. We gave them La Folie, a 6-minute, very controversial song in French. Golden Brown is partly about heroin. When did the drug darken your door? I think Hugh got introduced to heroin by one of the Tubes in L.A. He was making his Nofra 2 album with Captain Beefheart's drummer, Robert Williams. And I was making my first solo album, Euroman Cometh. Hugh and I discussed heroin use and decided to make a Stranglers album after a whole year of us all taking it. This was the gospel according to the Mean Black LP. Yeah, which sounds completely out of it, laughs. It wasn't very commercial, but I think it's a masterpiece. It was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Let's take something and see what happens. Jed and Dave quit heroin after a week, but me and Hugh continued. We started to have visions. We thought we were the Matrix, and the real world was out in space. Jet, who was brought up Irish Catholic, couldn't stand the whole thing. It reminded him of organized religion. How did you get clean? Well, with Dave's help, one summer's day, I woke up about 4 in the afternoon. I looked in the mirror, and there was nothing left of me. I was gray. All the muscles had gone. I'd stopped training. My world had gotten very small, and I wasn't interested in anything. Dave turned up, probably wanting to play music or go to the pub. And when he saw the state of me, he very deliberately got me drunk for 2 days solid, for which I'll be forever grateful. After that, I realized that I needed to get clean. It had reached the point where I wasn't even interested in girls. If I could get an erection, it wouldn't go down. 5-6 hours later, the girl would be like, "Can you bring this to some kind of conclusion, sir?" Amazing to get clean in 2 days. Well, none of us were fixing. We were sniffing. When Hugh got clean as well, they found a whole fucking pharmacy on him while he was driving to London, and he ended up in the Pentville. That was the end of the Stranglers and heroin. It was nothing romantic. Can you explain the band's lack of traction in America? Weren't you interested in the States? Hugh was, but I wasn't. I found it tedious. All our peers going over there bending the knee, like everyone's doing with Trump. The Clash, U2, all suddenly wearing cowboy hats. I'm sorry, I'm a European, and I don't want to live in the shadow of America. Later on, 1984's Skin Deep got to number one in the U.S. college charts, which meant something in those days, but I didn't want to be away from Europe for more than a few months. And here's a little bit of that song, Skin Deep, by the Stranglers.
Many people tell you that they're your friend. Leave them, you need them, for what's round the river bend. Make sure that you're receiving the signals they send. Cause brother, you've only got 2 hands to lend. Loom up ahead when you're asleep. Some days there's things on your mind you should keep. Sometimes it's tougher to look than to leave. Better watch out for the skin deep. watch out for the skinny.
Why did Hugh leave the Stranglers in 1990? He said you'd gone as far as you could, artistically speaking. That's true, but success had gone to his head. To all of our heads, actually, but I'd got over it, and he hadn't. He was still going to New York for weekends with his American model girlfriend, or whatever. He'd got lost in showbiz. Was there a final straw? While rehearsing for our last tour, Jet showed me this Cosmopolitan article. At the end of a busy week in London, Hugh Cornwell drives his Range Rover to his West Country retreat near Bath. Here, he was wearing a crew t-shirt and a sweater from Ballerman. I mean, fuck! Then Hugh came in and the crew started gigging. Hugh's like, what's up? Total silence. But Jet had very conspicuously left the article open on the table. When Hugh did leave, did you think, here's my chance to shine? No, because I thought of Hugh as my elder brother. I often deferred to him, even towards the end in the late 80s when we were on sabbatical and I was playing in my R&B covers band, the Purple Helmets. One of the songs we did was The Kinks, All Day and All the Night, which the Stranglers, scratching around for material, then did as a single. Hugh was like, great, I think I can sing that one. I'd wanted to sing it, actually, but again, I deferred to him. You just used the word brother with regard to Hugh. Is there still some love there? Yeah, a bit, for what he was, but he's become very bitter. I've heard from various sources that he's like, why do the Stranglers still exist? How dare they? It's simple. There's a huge appetite for us. Hugh, meanwhile, isn't doing so well. When people shouted out for Strangler songs at his solo shows, he used to say, they're playing down the road. Fuck off. Now he does half a set of Strangler stuff. I think he has to. A major documentary film about the Stranglers was supposed to come out in 2019. Where are you up to? Well, Hugh put a block on it for years, but since John Lydon lost that high court battle with Steve Jones and Paul Cook, relicensing Sex Pistols songs for TV use, the feeling is we can go ahead. It just needs editing and updating. The director, David Bonney, recently sourced another $50,000 of funding. Hopefully, it'll be out next year. At what point did you realize the Stranglers would be fine without Hugh? Probably not until 2004's No Frick Coast. In the late 90s, we weren't garnering much attention. Our audiences were getting smaller, and my private life was a fucking disaster with my marriage falling apart. Over lunch, my publisher, Martin Costello, said, I can see you're not in a good place. Here's $25,000 to rent a little isolated place alone. He said, write JJ. I know you can. So I disappeared to this old Jacobean cottage in Norfolk right on the beach. And within a week, I'd written Norfolk Coast. It was a great feeling. Everything just flowed, and it changed our fortunes. Which bands have told you they're Stranglers fans? Simple Minds, U2, The Damned, Inspiral Carpets? One of the loveliest things was Jacques Dutronic asking me to play on his 1978 comeback album, COF Dutronic. He was cool as fuck. I'd listened to psychedelic pop stuff as a kid, and he was married to Frances Hardy, of course. Francisco's later said one of her big regrets was not working with the Stranglers. How would you like to be remembered? Well, I'd like the Stranglers to be remembered as one of the most original and innovative bands of the post-war era. But we probably won't get that recognition. We've made too many enemies. Philosophically speaking, what is rock and roll and what is not? Well, it's not dyeing your hair with Just for Men at the age of 70. And it's not wearing a bandana and pretending you're from L.A. It's about complete freedom of expression, musically and lyrically. My attitude is, don't take any shit. And now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Weezer's Blue Album, After 30 Years. Weezer's debut album, Weezer, or the Blue Album, is quite possibly one of the most iconic albums of all time. At the very least, its cover art is the most iconic of all time. The visual of four guys standing in front of a very specific shade of blue is somehow memorable enough that if I see a blank blue square that is even vaguely similar to the Weezer shade, I will start hearing the lick to Buddy Holly in my brain. Is this album still as good as people remember it being? Even after 30 years, yes, absolutely, without a question. And here's a little bit of the song Buddy Holly by Weezer. I first wanted to see if I could interview any of the band members about the album, but I never got a response. So I asked the next closest person to Rivers Cuomo, himself, Matt Barchetto. I asked him what Weezer meant to him, expecting a joke answer. However, he responded, "Honestly, it makes me think of my dad. We listened to a bit of it and bonded over it. Listening again to the album, the feeling of goes nostalgia is very obvious. Songs like Buddy Holly and Undone feel so goes. It's almost palatable. And yet, these songs have aged so well. Well, not no one else. But I have a feeling that it's meant to be ironic." And here's a little bit of the song Undone by Weezer. Nine out of the 10 songs on this album are perfect power pop songs that make you either feel the good times or help you through bad points in your life, all of them managing to be effectively catchy. The best examples of these are, of course, Buddy Holly's chorus and solo, as well as My Name is Jonas, a fun dynamic change, the choruses On Holiday and Surf Wax America, and their Beach Boys-esque whimsy and Say It Ain't So's immortal lyrics, Flip on the Telly, Wrestle with Jimmy. Timely, truly timeless. Here's some of the songs Say It Ain't So by Weezer.
Oh, yeah. All right. Somebody's hiding, it's drowning my icebox. Somebody's cold one is giving me chills. Guess I'll just close my eyes. Oh yeah.
This album is so iconic and classic, it almost goes without saying. If you've only seen the record's cover art and maybe listened to Buddy Holly or Undone once or twice, I highly recommend picking this album up and giving it a listen. And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. Start off with an article about a girl group that I wasn't familiar with called The Roaches. And then it's going to be a countdown of Oasis' greatest songs and a classic album review of For the Roses by Joni Mitchell. Until then, this is Andy Bommack for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.